Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories. You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org. Thanks for listening to the podcast. A new report released today reveals the economic impact of Asian Americans in Arizona. From the KJZZ Business Desk, Christina Estes reports on the key findings involving business owners.
According to research conducted by West Group for the Arizona Asian Chamber of Commerce, about half of businesses surveyed started just before or during the recession.
These are survivors.
They're quiet survivors, according to Glenn Iwata. While leading the research project, he said it was challenging to get people to talk about their work. Iwata found Asians in Arizona were the least likely to promote their status as minority-owned businesses and to market to minorities.
78% of the Asians do not target specific minority groups. In other words, yes, we are Asian, but we don't want to make a big deal of it.
While one-third of business owners reported ethnic-related challenges that led to slurs, lost opportunities, and discriminatory behavior, they also mentioned positive stereotypes like being seen as smart and hardworking can help. Vietnamese, Chinese, and Asian Indian make up the largest group of business owners. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Arizona House and Senate are voting on a new state budget today. Debate and voting are happening right now, as a matter of fact. For an update, we turn to Jim Small, editor of the Arizona Capital Times. And Jim, where are we right now? Is a long day projected? Where do we stand right now?
Yeah, definitely be a long day. I mean, they are in the midst of voting, debating and voting on these bills in both chambers right now. Essentially the process is everything has to go up for a floor debate, and there's a chance for amendments to be added onto bills. Some bills are being amended by Republicans. Essentially, they're adding in language and changing the provisions of the budget to comport with the deal that was struck between House Republicans and Senate Republicans in the governor's office. Democrats have tried to offer some amendments here and there, but so far all of those Democratic amendments have been rejected, and I think that's probably what we can expect to see for the rest of the day.
Well, speaking of amendments, we had talked last week about the possibility of Kids Care, the health insurance program for kids of working poor parents, being reinstated as an amendment. It looks like that's not going to happen.
Yeah, that seems a little bit up in the air. There was a plan in both chambers from a Republican representative and a Republican senator to offer that amendment in each chamber as they debated the bills. The House Representative Regina Cobb from Mojave County, for some reason we're not quite sure yet why she essentially said she's not going to be offering her amendment to restore kids care. In the Senate, Senator Jeff Dial from the Chandler area told us that regardless of that, he still plans on putting his amendment on the floor, and he thinks that it'll have the votes to pass and to get added into the budget. That obviously would create a bit of a sticky situation if the Senate budget included restoring kids care and the House budget didn't. So, that's something I think that we'll probably get a lot more clarity on here in the next 3 or 4 hours. But as of right now, it looks like they might be on something of a collision course to have different budgets.
So these votes were supposed to happen last week. There's maybe going to happen again yesterday, and now they're finally happening today. What changed to allow this to go forward today?
Essentially, what happened was, last week this thing kind of ran into a wall when it became apparent that there were a lot of Republicans, I think specifically in the House, although there were, I think, a couple in the Senate as well, who weren't happy with the terms of the budget, and specifically they didn't like the way it handled some of the education funding issues and the fact that there were de facto cuts baked into this budget for K-12 public schools. That's the main thing that got resolved, and they came to terms yesterday and worked out the specific language that they wanted to put into the budget to ensure basically that these schools are held harmless for some of these policy shifts that were going to cost some money. They probably could have, if they really wanted to, stayed really, really late last night and well into the early hours this morning to try to get this budget done. But it looks like they made the probably good decision to go ahead and call it a night early in the evening, let all this language be drafted by staff, and then come back early this morning and actually tackle this in the light of day as opposed to, after midnight.
So, Jim, what have been some of the big points of contention that have come up during a floor debate and voting? Obviously, a lot of Republicans on board with this budget. Democrats are probably not.
Yeah, Democrats are not on board with this. The main points of contention from Democrats have been tax policy and education spending. Democrats want some of these the tax cuts that are either on the books currently or are scheduled to be phased in over the next year or two to be either if not eliminated outright, at least delayed. And then on the education side, they've been pushing for more spending. There have been a couple amendments to increase spending for K-12 and for universities. As I mentioned earlier, I mean, so far, those aren't part of the deal. Those aren't part of what Republican leadership is supportive. So those amendments have all been rejected by the Republican majority.
Jim Small is editor of the Arizona Capital Times. Jim, thanks as always.
You bet.
The Phoenix City Council will take up a proposal for the new city budget later this hour. Council members will vote on the spending plan later this month. City Manager Ed Zuercher has said this budget has proven to be, quote, the most challenging budget in recent memory. He joins me, and Ed, that sounds a bit surprising, especially since recent memory includes the Great Recession.
I think it's really reflecting the three things that are converging at the same time, which have never converged in my memory in Phoenix, and that is, first of all, just a budget in and of itself for $3 billion corporation is complicated. You layer over that the fact that we're in the middle of labor negotiations with our employee unions, and they're really important because employees have taken concessions over 6 years and they want to get them restored. And that's what we had 2 years ago. But the third factor that really complicated it more than anything was the fact of our property tax rate discussion, that for the first time in 21 years, we have to have a conversation about raising our property tax rate. That's sort of the piece that really made this a complex budget.
On the property tax, your budget proposes raising the secondary property tax, which is basically the market value of somebody's home, which would bring in about $37 million to the city. What would that money fund, and how would Phoenicians see that or feel that increase?
Well, it's really sort of a threshold question, because the $37 million, what it does is it allows us to pay our debt service costs. We have to pay that. That's the money we're paying for the police stations, fire stations, parks, libraries, storm basins that we've built over the last 30 years. When we take care of that question, then it allows us to use the budget surplus that we have for the things that people say they want for their quality of life. You know, more public safety, more youth and parks programming, more library services, arts, those things, as well as it allows us to restore the concessions that our employees gave us. So it really is a two-step question that the property tax allows us to have resources for quality of life, things for the community.
The budget also calls for hiring more police officers and firefighters, but there seems to be a little bit of debate as far as hiring more officers and or providing body cameras, compensation packages. Where do you fall as far as what should happen as far as public safety with the available money that Phoenix has?
Sure. Well, I think it's a false choice to set it up that we can only do one or two or the other. And this budget shows a way to do all three things that you mentioned. We can hire more officers, and we will be hiring 145 more officers next year in the budget. We can restore employee compensation. It takes us a little longer, 3 years instead of 2 years, to get there, but we got our employee groups to sign up for that, and we can have body cameras. It's going to take us 5 years to get our officers all outfitted rather than three, but we think that that's responsible. So we can actually accomplish all those things a little in a responsible period of time. And I think it's important.
When it comes to services, is the city's goal to restore services to what they were before the recession, or is there some sort of new normal that you're looking for to get to and then sort of maintain where that is?
Sure. I think there is a new normal. Certainly the world is much different from 2009, and we're a different organization. We've really found ways to be efficient and lean. We've trimmed almost $110 million of savings and new revenues into our budget through employee suggestions and ideas and community suggestions. So that's a new normal. I think we want to restore, and what we hear from people is they want us to get back to library hours, swimming pool hours, park programs, senior center hours, those things that really affect the quality of life for the community, and they're willing to pay a little more for us to get there and do that. But we're not just going to blindly go back to what we did before. It's really going to have to be examined of, does the community still work this way? Is this really what people want?
Phoenix City Manager Ed Zuercher. Ed, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Mark. Appreciate your time.
A federal appeals court says holds on two state identity theft laws should be lifted. The laws were the legal basis for Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio's worksite raids that targeted unauthorized immigrants working with fake papers. Joining me now is KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block to talk about the ruling. Hi, Jude.
Hi, Mark.
So let's back up. What do these two laws do, and why were they challenged in the first place?
So the laws make it a felony to use a fake identity to seek work. And the language in the laws is neutral. But here in Maricopa County, the sheriff's office used them mostly to prosecute hundreds of immigrants in the country illegally working with fake papers. And by prosecuting these immigrants, it would basically ensure they'd be deported because they'd be turned over to ICE custody and their felony conviction would make them a priority for removal.
And then in 2014, these laws were first challenged by the immigrant rights group Puente. What grounds did they challenge them on?
So they had a few arguments, and one was that it's the federal government's job to regulate who has legal authorization to work. And so these state laws were preempted by federal law, they argued. On those grounds, a federal judge agreed to block the laws while Puente's lawsuit went forward. But yesterday, a panel from the Ninth Circuit reversed that ruling, and they pointed out the laws on their face could be applied to anyone, like U.S. citizens who are trying to hide their true identities to get a job because maybe they have a felony conviction. And for that reason, the Ninth Circuit found the laws aren't necessarily infringing on the federal government's exclusive immigration domain.
So, Jude, could we see Sheriff Arpaio reinstate his worksite raids as a result of this ruling?
Well, the first thing to keep in mind is that nothing's going to happen immediately because there's a 21-day period before the laws can be reinstated, and it's also possible Puente will appeal. But Arpaio issued a statement yesterday saying he's not decided yet when or if he'll reinstate the identity theft enforcement. He also said he's going to be reviewing the settlement he signed last summer with the U.S. Department of Justice. That was over a separate civil rights lawsuit. But that settlement spells out a whole host of new protocols he has to follow if he ever wants to start the worksite raids again, including seeking approval.
So something that was interesting about Monday's ruling is that we have the Ninth Circuit ruling in favor of Maricopa County and Arizona on something related to immigration. It's not something that you see every day.
That's right. I mean, usually the Ninth Circuit is reversing Arizona and Maricopa County immigration policies. The plaintiffs will point out that this is just an intermediate step in the lawsuit. The ruling did not address some of their other legal arguments, and so this issue isn't really resolved yet.
That's KJZZ's Jude Joffe Blanc. Thanks, Jude.
Thank you, Mark.
This week is Arizona Travel and Tourism Week. It's part of the U.S. Travel Association's annual National Travel and Tourism Week, and it's a chance for the tourism industry here to tout its economic impact on the state. In 2014, that amounted to more than $20 billion in direct visitor spending and $2.8 billion in federal, state, and local tax revenues, according to the Arizona Office of Tourism. The show's Lauren Gilger caught up with their deputy director this morning. And Lauren, people from their office are all over the place today, right?
That's right. They're calling today their rally day, and they're going to be at locations all over the valley handing out random acts of sunshine, which can be gift cards to restaurants or passes to Arizona parks or tickets to attractions all over the state. So this morning I caught up with Stephanie Dowling, the deputy director of the Arizona Office of Tourism, and we talked about the economic impact of tourism here in Arizona. I met her at the Cholla Trailhead at Camelback Mountain just after she finished hiking all the way to the summit and back. The Office of Tourism actually had 30 people out there at 4:15 to hike the mountain this morning to kick off the day right.
So tell me, how big is the tourism industry here in Arizona? How much does this impact our state's economy?
So tourism is extremely important to economic development in any community, and research shows that destination marketing to market tourism drives economic development. So it's 20 million visitors that come every year on average, driving over $40 billion in spending. So that's a lot of tax revenue back to the state. So it goes back into the community directly. So it's what funds our educational system. It's also what funds our emergency personnel and teachers. And so it's a really important economic driver. And oftentimes it's the very first part of economic development. So business owners and, you know, companies will come to visit first before they make the decision to invest in that state or that community. And then they also oftentimes will relocate and or hire employees from our state.
So what does it mean that tourism is our state's biggest export? Why is it an export industry?
Tourism is considered the number one export for Arizona. And what that means is a lot of money from outside of the state that's coming into the state. It's incredibly important, even on an international stage. So 14% of our visitors come from international markets. So in a time when currency issues can, you know, kind of affect travel, especially from an international standpoint, when our currency is so strong and others are not, we're still seeing a lot of international travelers because they see the value in traveling to the United States. It's something that they want to do, and they love choosing Arizona. Arizona has a lot to offer.
So it's a beautiful morning out here today, but it's going to get hot here pretty soon. And how does that kind of shift your campaign? And you advertise to in-state residents a lot, right?
We do. And so coming into the summer season, we really do shift our focus to marketing more in-state. Our number one feeder market for the summer season is Arizona residents. So we know that Arizonans are just used to getting out and experiencing their state in the summertime. So we want to make sure that they know about all the great things to do, add to their bucket list, really encouraging them to get out and experience their state, explore Arizona.
And does that drive as much economic activity as out-of-state residents and international people coming in?
It does. Arizona residents are the ones that are spending money at our attractions and our hotels, and it's just as important as marketing to other destinations within the United States and also internationally.
Well, thank you so much for being with us here, and thanks for meeting me at the bottom of the trail. I hope you can get some water.
Yes, it was a great hike, but we have a long day ahead of us, so we're looking forward to it.
That was Stephanie Dowling, Deputy Director of the Arizona Office of Tourism, speaking with the show's Lauren Gilger about Arizona Travel and Tourism Week. Close to 1,800 people showed up last night for a public meeting held by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Lake Havasu City. That's because of a proposed change in boating regulations in and around Lake Havasu.
We had existing restrictions along 17.5 miles. What we're proposing now is to extend restrictions an additional 2 miles.
Christine Tincher is with the Fish and Wildlife Service. She's talking about a 2-mile zone in the north end of the lake. The proposed changes would restrict speeds of motorized boats to 5 miles an hour and would prohibit water skiing, tubing, and wakeboarding.
So we're talking about a small area and keeping it open for passage by restricting the speeds within certain areas.
But Lake Havasu City Mayor Mark Nexon says he's concerned about the proposed changes because it's an important area to local watercraft businesses. This time last year, the Fish and Wildlife Service imposed similar restrictions on a half-mile stretch in the lake, which Nexon says received pushback.
It may not sound like much, a half a mile, but it turns out that that 1/2 mile was an area of a backwater that was used by recreational boaters to teach their kids how to wakeboard, water ski, etc., for decades.
The Fish and Wildlife Service says animal habitats, like those of migratory birds, are being damaged. That, along with safety concerns, creates a need for these changes. The next public meeting on the proposed changes is tonight. The Fish and Wildlife Service is taking public comment through May 12th. A Southern California community recently experienced the biggest natural gas leak in U.S. history.
A slow-motion environmental disaster in California where a torrent of methane gas is spewing into the air. Thousands have been relocated.
A state of emergency in response.
This infrared video shows gas rolling off the top of a nearby ridge down into the community.
There was a second leak, but that one was fixed much more quickly. But there is a lot of concern over ongoing environmental consequences from this disaster. Now get this. There's a much bigger source of methane pollution, but this one gives us our milkshakes and burgers. Each year, cows in the U.S. burp out 65 times more gas than was released in the now infamous California leak. From WHYY, Jessica McDonald reports on a discovery that could cut down those emissions.
I'm standing in Penn State University's Dairy Cow Research Barn. It's a bit smaller than a football field, single story, full of fluorescent lighting and the scent of fresh manure. In front of me, corralled in two long rows of stalls, are 60 black and white Holstein dairy cows, the classic kind featured on milk jugs. They're huge, 1,400 pounds each, with plastic yellow ID tags on their ears. Standing next to me is animal science professor Alex Pristov. He's Bulgarian with graying hair, and he looks proudly at his herd.
They milk about 100 pounds of milk a day. They eat a lot, so they're good cows.
All that eating, though, comes with a cost.
They burp gas all the time. They produce gas all the time, 24 hours.
Sadly for me and my microphone, the belching is silent. Kristoff is particularly concerned about methane. Methane doesn't last as long as carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but over a century, it traps heat 25 times better. About a quarter of the world's methane pollution comes from livestock, which is why Kristoff and his team have gotten very good at quantifying the amount their cows exhale. Prompted by some extra snacks, cow number 2050 ducks her head into a hooded machine that can analyze her burps.
And there is a slight vacuum through the system, so all the gases are captured going through the sensors.
During experiments, the scientists take 8 of these measurements from each cow over several days. In a few months, this gives a snapshot of just how much methane the animals churn out, and whether particular interventions work to cut those emissions. After a short drive back to the university's animal science lab building, Kristoff says the reason cows are such big producers of methane is part of what makes them so special. They can eat things humans, or even other farm animals, including pigs, can't, like grass and hay.
And it's all because of a symbiotic relationship with the bacteria in their rumen.
The rumen is the first section of the cow's famous 4-compartment stomach. It's where the food is first broken down into a slush by trillions of hardworking bacteria. Their job? To ferment the feed so that it can be turned into flesh or milk. In this fermentation process, a lot of hydrogen gas is made. If too much builds up, it can stop digestion. Luckily, there are bugs called methanogens that can take care of it.
And they have specialized into taking that hydrogen, taking the carbon dioxide, and putting it together and making methane that the animal burps out.
Scientists call it eructation. Contrary to popular belief, very little methane actually comes out the other end.
Cows really don't release anything from their backside.
One way to reduce the environmental impact of digestion is to try to chemically block the creation of methane. Kristoff's group has been testing an inhibitor to do just that. It's called 3-nitrooxypropanol, or 3-NOP, and prevents an enzyme in bacteria from powering the last step of methane formation. So far, the compound appears to work. In the team's study, methane emissions fell by 30%, a decrease that persisted for the entire 12-week period the cows were on the drug. Kristoff calls it a breakthrough.
I've been looking at methane for probably 15 years now, and this is the most exciting results that we have so far.
It's potentially great news for the environment, but it won't mean much if it's not used. And right now, farmers have no incentive to buy it.
Just reducing methane is not going to sell this.
Historically, methane inhibitors have been of interest to the beef industry, not as a way to cut greenhouse emissions, but to save money. Andy Cole, a retired USDA scientist in Texas, studied the drugs back in the mid-70s.
Now, at the time, that was before the term greenhouse gas or global warming had ever even been used.
The idea was just to find a more efficient, cheaper way to raise cattle. Up to 10% of a cow's food is wasted on making methane.
That's energy that possibly could have ended up in the muscle or in the milk.
In theory, by blocking methane formation, the animals can put those calories to better use, bulking up faster, pumping out more milk, making ranchers more money. But Cole never found an inhibitor that worked well. Many were toxic. 40 years later, Kristoff thinks he's onto something.
All the data we have are extremely positive.
It's still too early to say the inhibitor will be a success. Lots of tests are needed to make sure the compound is safe for cows, and of course, the humans who drink the milk. But if Histrov's right, the drug just might help farmers' pocketbooks as well as the planet.
That's Jessica McDonald from our partners at WHYY's The Pulse. There are lots of ways to gauge how conservative or liberal your city or town is, voter registration and election results being two of them. But a new analysis by the Silicon Valley startup CrowdPack looks at campaign contributions. The firm believes the best way to identify where a politician stands is to look at where they get their money. The company built a database of more than 100 million public records, which allowed it to look at all donations across time on the local, state, and federal levels. And it found most Valley cities are pretty close to the middle of the political spectrum. Mason Harrison is CrowdPack's political director.
What this also allows us to do is to map politicians and donors along a political spectrum based on their patterns of political giving, which gives us a keen insight into their political relationships and a great way of estimating sort of the gradation of ideology that you might have if you're either liberal or conservative.
Which candidates for office were you looking at? I mean, was this just federal races? Were you looking at members of state legislatures or city councils, things like that?
We look at every single politician who's ever accepted a donation that has been publicly reported and every single donor and who they've given to. And so what makes this interesting is we can actually look at, rather than just voting data, where we see sort of a very binary picture of what, you know, whether or not a district or an area is Republican or Democrat, we can actually look and tell you what kind of Republicans exist in that given area. Are they Republicans who would donate to a Rand Paul, for instance, or are they maybe a more moderate Republican that would donate to a John Kasich or even a John McCain? So, you know, these are the kinds of things that we think that campaign contribution data has very powerful insight in being able to provide information to both voters and donors.
I'm curious about how powerful this is, because obviously not everybody who votes and not necessarily everybody who supports a candidate chooses to give them money. So how far do you think you can take this data to really determine the political leanings, I guess you would call them, of a particular place, given that, yes, there might be donations from X number of people to this candidate or that candidate, but that's just sort of a small subset of all the potential voters in that place?
Sure, absolutely. And I'll use San Francisco as an example. It's where we're based. And although, you know, folks in Arizona might know San Francisco to be just very Democratic, knowing that doesn't tell you a lot about the kinds of Democrats that people in San Francisco support. And although, as you mentioned, campaign contributions only reflect a small subset of the population and not everybody does donate, they are an accurate reflection of a segment of the politically active members of that population. And you know, we have to assume that, you know, people of all stripes are giving and investing in campaigns. And importantly, factoring into our score, we do not only look at large campaign contributions. In fact, contribution size factors in very little into all of our scores. We look at the number of data points.
One of the things that seemed interesting about the data is that looking at a number of cities in the Phoenix area, they were all roughly within like plus or minus four of the middle, that nothing was terribly conservative, nothing was terribly liberal. And it seemed striking because in other publications, for example, Mesa has been labeled the most conservative city in America. And you think about places even like Tucson, which are seen in Arizona as a fairly left-leaning place, aren't that liberal compared to sort of the continuum that you guys had set up.
Absolutely. Well, so, you know, again, what you're describing are more voter trends than actual campaign contributions. And so that will definitely factor into the overall result. But what's fascinating about looking at campaign contribution data is you actually do get a much more accurate picture of, you know, the other side that is often not reflected in sort of the binary choice that, again, you know, when we talk about Republican and Democrat districts, when you look at Tucson or Phoenix, the score tends to be much closer to zero, meaning that you have a heavy amount of contributions on both the Republican and the Democratic side. So, you know, while those donors may not necessarily manifest themselves in the voting results and might paint certain areas of the state, you know, very blue or seem to suggest a sort of a one-party makeup, we can actually look at campaign contribution data and tell you that, you know, look, actually, there's a strong base of support for both the Republican side and the Democrat side in a certain area. And the specific districts you mentioned actually tend to give pretty even handily to politicians on both sides of the aisle.
Mason Harrison is political director for the firm CrowdPack. Mason, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
As more companies and government agencies find themselves dealing with data breaches, the importance of qualified workers in the cybersecurity field becomes more clear. But are American colleges and universities producing enough of them? We have a couple of perspectives on this today, starting with Vincent Weifer, Vice President of McAfee Labs. Vincent, are there enough people with cybersecurity skills coming through the pipeline?
So let me start at this far end, which says every data point we have that says the industry is struggling from a lack of trained cybersecurity professionals. Today, the estimated gap is around 200,000 people. That's expected to rise up to 2 million people by 2020. So there's absolutely a significant gap in what is needed versus what has been produced from the high schools all the way up to the university level.
That seems like a really big gap. How do you go about trying to close that?
There's a lot of initiatives trying to really help people with the notion of the science, technologies, engineering, and maths type programs. And it almost didn't become cool for many years for people to go into those programs. And now we're trying to encourage people to go back in, look at the potential of these careers, particularly when you're talking about underrepresented minorities, such as females, other groups, to help them really get into this career, because we believe it's a fantastic place to show your skills. It's a great place for people of all sorts of diversity backgrounds to really show their contribution.
So do you think that it is a marketing problem, or do you think there's something else going on?
Well, I think there's a couple of things playing into this. One is an awareness at the high school level around the type of careers and the type of challenges that are available in this area. So people may have a view of it's just engineering. In my world, we deal with research. We deal with cyber criminals. It's a research. It's a investigative. It's a fascinating area. When you think of all how the landscape has changed over the last decade in terms of who the attackers are, we've gone from the individual hackers. We've gone into the cyber criminals, you've got the state actors, you've got a development of complexity, sophistication. All of that says this is a constantly evolving and changing areas. And so understanding that, getting people excited about that, the possibilities, the multiple types of careers that are available, I think is one of our challenges.
When you talk about the fact that sort of the bad guys are evolving, I'm curious if that is a pool of potential candidates that that firms like yours look to?
That's a really interesting question, because I think multiple surveys around the world have said that companies are willing to hire from the sort of hacker community. And if I make a distinction between people who are hackers in the truest sense, which is they like investigating, they like breaking things, understand how things work, but would never do anything criminal, versus crackers, people who do it for criminal enterprise. We have a very moral side which says we would never hire somebody who does criminal activities. It is so important for the trust relationship we have with our customers to say we're never going to hire those type of people. But if you have somebody who may have come up through high school, they like investigating, they like playing with computers, the truest sense of the word hackers, absolutely, they're the type of people you want to bring in, you want to give them opportunities, you want to help them learn. And again, we find that this is an area that appeals to all groups. There's a huge interest in this space once we can just spark that imagination and give them the opportunities.
Vincent Weifer is Vice President of McAfee Labs. For another perspective, we turn to Jamie Winterton, Director of Strategy at ASU's Global Security Initiative. And Jamie, is this something universities have had to play catch-up on?
Everyone is always playing catch-up in cybersecurity because the threat landscape is changing so frequently and it's changing so fast. So we did look out and see that there was a big need for more people in cybersecurity, not just more people in cybersecurity, but more people that could think broadly about the different aspects of it. And one of the big differences is we looked at cybersecurity as an inherently interdisciplinary problem. So it's not something that should just be buried in a computer science department. It's not something that should just be buried in the law school. We need the computer scientists and the lawyers to talk to each other. We need people from the business school. We have people from the psychology department. We have people from the English department, all working on how does cybersecurity affect people and how can we approach it from all of these different ways.
Do you have a lot of students coming to ASU who want to go into this field?
We do have a lot of people that come and say they want to do cybersecurity, and then shaping for them what that means. When we talk about cybersecurity, we also need to talk about what exactly is it that we're securing. Are we securing mobile devices? Are we securing large corporate networks? Are we securing personal health information? Are we securing identities? All of these things are different components of it and will help to shape a student's pathway through the university.
do they tend to know all of the different aspects that are needed to or that are possible in this field?
Not initially. They tend to come in and say, do I need to hack something to be part of your program? And we say, no, you don't have to. And we recommend that you not hack something on campus, please. But unless you're part of a team or you're working on a lab or something like that, there are opportunities to get hands-on experience on that. But we try to show them it's something that has a human element to it as well, that you don't have to be a serious coder to do cybersecurity. You can look at cybersecurity from the business perspective. You can look at the user perspective. So what kind of warnings are better for users? We don't do a great job at communicating with users right now. For example, something pops up and it says something about an SSL certification and people think, I don't know what this means. I just want it to go away so I can use the internet again. So we have a lot of work to do in understanding that human aspect of it too.
I'm interested to hear you talk about that human aspect because I think for a lot of people, they think of cybersecurity and they think of people sitting in front of a computer, typing away, coding with ones and zeros, and not necessarily ever interacting with another human being.
Right, and it couldn't be further from the truth. If you think about the kinds of attacks that we've seen recently, the high-level breaches, and I'm talking Target, Home Depot, RSA Secure ID, all of those attacks started with a social engineering element. There are also people on the other side of it, too, people that are being affected by these attacks, people with identities. If it weren't for people, we wouldn't really need cybersecurity.
Do you think that we will ever get to the point where there are enough people in this field to meet the demand of employers and universities and governments and anybody who might need cybersecurity folks?
We definitely need to fill the jobs that are out there. There's a pressing need to do that. But there's as strong a need to educate individuals. Cybersecurity for normal people is what I call it, instead of just having it be a computer science term. Let's make sure that people understand what they can do to protect their own information in their own lives.
Jamie Winterton is Director of Strategy at ASU's Global Security Initiative. A civil rights group says the Tucson Police Department is holding people at traffic stops longer than it should in order to check their immigration status. From our Fronteras desk in Tucson, KJZZ's Michelle Marisco reports the complaints stem from the city's enforcing a slice of Arizona's immigration law, SB 1070.
A lawyer for the American Civil Liberties Union said it reviewed 110 traffic stops by the Tucson Police Department. In 85 of those, officers held people for longer than a routine traffic stop should take. Immigration statuses were checked, and sometimes the Border Patrol was called in. The ACLU says as a result, those stopped were held longer than they should have been. ACLU attorney James Lyle.
In many cases, Tucson PD was explicit about the fact that they were extending the stops solely to wait for Border Patrol to arrive. In some cases, passengers were detained without any probable cause of criminal wrongdoing, and in some cases driven to meet the Border Patrol in order to transfer custody.
The immigration enforcement is a provision of Arizona's SB 1070 law. It requires officers to check the immigration status of anyone they stop if the officer suspects the person is in the U.S. illegally. The ACLU claims that Tucson officers go far beyond what that provision allows. In some cases, people were detained as long as 3 hours. In others, people were held more than an hour before Border Patrol agents determined they were actually U.S. citizens. Lyle acknowledged that there's no hard and fast rule on how long a traffic stop should take. But he points out a Supreme Court case from last year where the court ruled that even a 7-minute delay over the time the officer needed to make the stop was unconstitutional.
The result is a lot of people's civil rights are being violated.
The data on the lengthy traffic stops was collected within the tenure of the city's former police chief. The current chief, Christopher Magnus, sent a statement Monday afternoon that he had already planned to meet with the ACLU next week to discuss the issue. 2 years ago, Councilwoman Regina Romero was among those who pressed Tucson police to adopt an electronic system to detail traffic stops specifically because of 1070's enforcement provision.
The stop data is not only there to use by groups to take back this issue to the Supreme Court and say, look, we told you it was going to have disparate impact on minority Latinos in the state of Arizona. But the stop data is also there for the chief to make sure that he's looking at the data and he's asking questions as to why.
The ACLU's criticism also extends to the Obama administration for using the U.S. Border Patrol to assist Tucson police in its enforcement of 1070. Michel Marisco, KJZZ News, Tucson.
It's the show for Tuesday, May 3rd. Thanks for listening. Along with the Takeaways, John Hockenberry today, I'm Mark Brody. Most of the southwestern United States rely on dams for water. These dams play a pretty important role for the millions who live here. The importance of these structures is being magnified in a disturbing scene in a country in our own hemisphere.
A cascade of failures and neglect has plunged the nation of Venezuela into a 21st century chaos that may be a hint of disturbing things to come in this century. Protests, blackouts, a newly imposed two-day work week for all government workers, schools have been closed on Fridays, all because of a drought-induced energy crisis at the massive Guri Dam, home to Venezuela's largest hydroelectric power station. As Hannah Dreyer, the Venezuela correspondent for the Associated Press, reports from Caracas, it's just the beginning of Venezuela's problems right now.
There is a sense here that the lights are going out in this country. It's not just President Nicolas Maduro who is freaking out about the lower water levels at the Guri Dam. Everybody here is freaking out about this. There's a real possibility that the whole country is going to be in blackout. This is a country where already it's become acceptable to skip work to go grocery shopping, where already there's an informal curfew and people don't leave their houses at night. Already, virtually everybody who can is trying to find a way to move out of the country and go to Miami or go to Colombia. And so this electricity crisis is, it's insult to injury. It's just another way that it feels like the whole country is collapsing.
Venezuela's case is special in that the entire infrastructure of the country has been neglected for years. Can you describe that?
That's right. So what we have happening right now in Venezuela is two things. There's a profound drought, and that really is happening in Caracas right now. It smells like a campfire. The hills are totally dry and they're burning. We haven't had rain for months and months. And the other thing that's happening is that there just hasn't been the investment here that experts, even the government itself, said was needed years ago. So back in 2010, President Hugo Chavez said that he was going to spend billions of dollars to build lots of new electricity generating plants. He did spend billions of dollars, but those new plants never got online. And so the whole country is dependent on this one dam to provide energy. And as the drought continues, water levels there are falling below the turbines. And if that happens, the whole country will be plunged into the dark.
And with oil prices at this level, the government cannot pay its bills, and there's no sign for any relief there, right?
Right. When President Hugo Chavez was at his height, oil prices were at about $100 a barrel. Now they're down to half that. The country can't pay to import food, can't pay to import medicine, and isn't letting multinational companies take their profits out, which means that those companies are leaving. That's why it's hard to get an international flight out of Venezuela, hard to make an international call from here.
And the poor in Venezuela do have a long memory, and their sense that Hugo Chavez died with any of the good luck that Venezuela could ever have has fueled this opposition that could actually remove President Maduro from power. What is the state of play in this petition drive?
Right. The poor were left out of the Venezuelan political discourse for most of this country's history. Hugo Chavez came to power and for the first time included the poor in the spoils of the country's oil wealth. And that was a huge shift and one that isn't going away. People love Hugo Chavez, who died 3 years ago. People aren't going to stop loving him. But what you hear a lot is, I'm Chavista, but I'm not Madurista, which means they support Chavez, but they don't support the new president, Nicolas Maduro. And that's because things have just become unlivable here. You know, there are food lines, there's insane crime, everybody's been robbed. And now you come home and you can't turn on the lights and there's no water coming out of your tap.
And three-digit inflation, that's just one of the maladies that form that bleak picture that you've described so vividly. Speaking from Caracas, Heine Dreyer is Venezuela correspondent for the Associated Press. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. Is it possible for a blind person to see using only sound? Well, an 11-year-old boy from Scotland has been learning to do just that with a little bit of help from the U.S. The BBC's Helena Merriman reports.
Meet Ethan. He's sitting at the piano in his living room, practicing one of his favorite pieces. He's only 11 years old, and he's been blind since birth. So he's never seen a stave of music, or his piano. He hears complex compositions like this, and learns them by ear. Last year, Ethan auditioned for one of the top music schools in the country, St. Mary's in Edinburgh. It's a small school, so competition is tough. But to his surprise, he got in.
It's just amazing that a school like St. Mary's exists.
But there was a problem. Ethan struggles to get around. Sometimes he wanders into the road and his parents have to pull him back. So they decided to call on one man who they thought could help him. His name is Daniel Kish, and like Ethan, he's blind. But somehow, he knows what's around him.
I know they said it was down here, so it must be back this way.
We're on our way to a playground that Daniel's never been to before. When we get there, Daniel starts describing what's in it.
Now here we have a tree on the other side of the fence. So we have trees.
What he's doing is called echolocation. He makes a clicking noise with his tongue on the roof of his mouth and then listens to hear how his clicks echo off the things around him.
Every click returns with information that carries patterns that correspond to the nature of the surface from which the click returned. There's a lower, more solid object here. It is the fence, but there's something behind the fence. Yes, right,
exactly right. Exactly right. It's a double fence. And right. So you could hear that there were two fences.
Yes, exactly.
Daniel's here in Scotland to teach Ethan to see how he does, through echolocation. He's done some sessions with Ethan before, but this time, Ethan's really got to crack it.
So Ethan, would you like to start with a click exercise?
Okay.
We're going to be using this book.
That's tiny.
Yes, it's tiny. I'll place it, and then you would do what you need to do to find the book. I'm going to put it somewhere around your head, okay? Now go.
Daniel holds the book to the right of Ethan's face. Ethan starts clicking, listening out for that more intense echo. He turns to the left. Nothing. Then to the right. He hears it, reaches out, and grabs the book.
There you are. Beautiful.
Daniel decides to take him on a long walk, up a 1,400-foot hill along narrow, rocky paths.
Whoa! I fell into the river.
After a difficult start, Ethan begins to focus, listening to the echoes of his clicks, rather than getting distracted by all the other noises around him.
You're doing great. I like the way you're using your cane right now. Keep it up. And we're also seeing an increased rate of speed, by and large.
Back at his house, we talk about how the training's going.
What's changed for you this week?
I'm not walking around blind. I know I am actually blind, but I'm clicking so that I can hear echoes to help me find the ways.
Does it mean that you don't feel like you're blind?
It's kind of, yeah, I just see in a different way.
That's the voice of 11-year-old Ethan Locke, ending that story from the BBC's Helena Merriman. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.